From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin Monday ordered the withdrawal of his country's forces from Syria, and there were reports from Russian media that the withdrawal had begun Tuesday.
In a short period of time, Russia created a small but very effective military group in Syria. The effective work of our military forces allowed the peace process to begin. I think the task of Russia's defense ministry and the Russian troops is in general complete. Syrian government troops and patriotic forces can change the situation in the fight with international terrorism and can seize the initiative.
Russia's defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, said his forces' work had been completed.
With the airstrikes, we managed to reduce and in some areas to completely cut off the supply lines of the terrorists' trade in hydrocarbons. The main routes of the trade with Turkey have been cut off, as well as the main routes which provided the terrorists with weapons.
Russia will continue to maintain its permanent naval base at Tartus and its permanent air base in Latakia. RT's Lizzie Phelan is in Syria, and she filed this report.
Prior to Russia launching its air campaign, there was absolutely no question in most of the opposition's minds about negotiating with the Syrian government. However, almost on a daily basis, reconciliation deals are being reached with many of the factions and the Syrian government. You have to bear in mind that there's hundreds, if not more than 1,000, different factions amongst the opposition in Syria. So this has been a hugely significant development. We traveled to the north of the country, to Afrin province, where the Syrian Democratic Forces largely control that province, predominantly the Kurdish Kurdish militia, the YPG, and they have an unofficial cooperation with the Syrian government now for some time. We also spoke to one of the founders of a five-year-old Free Syrian Army faction called Jaish al-Thuwar. His name was Abu Joma al-Banawi, who said that now his group has no intention of continuing to fight the Syrian government. It's only interested in fighting ISIS and al-Qaeda's branch in Syria, Jabhat al-Nusra, and that once those groups are defeated, his group will lay down arms and work for security to return to Syria. So these are huge developments that prior to Russia launching its campaigns almost seemed unthinkable. And apart from the military developments on the ground, because of Russia's involvement, including huge gains in various provinces in Syria, for example, in Latakia, almost the entire province has been declared free of extremist groups. In Aleppo, there's been huge gains. There's also been huge gains on the humanitarian front, with humanitarian aid finally reaching besieged areas after years. And the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov spoke about this today.
We created an international group which included all the key players and regional powers as well. The agreements reached by this group on the political process in Syria have been backed by two resolutions by the UN Security Council. They include the ceasefire, humanitarian aid to previously blocked off areas, and the start of peace talks. Thanks to these agreements, including your latest agreement with Barack Obama, today in Geneva, we saw the peace talks resume.
The UN Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, met Monday with Syria's Ambassador Bashar al-Jaafari, who stressed to the press afterwards the need for talks involving Syria to be led by the Syrians themselves.
We want to have an inter-Syrian dialogue. Dialogue that is Syrian-led, without foreign intervention and without preconditions. Going against such the basic framework and such a method means that some are trying to sabotage this round once again, as they had done in the last round.
Under the framework agreement reached, de Mistura was set to meet with the opposition delegation Tuesday and then again with the government delegation Wednesday. Meanwhile, another war broke out Monday involving the U.S. and a Middle East country, this one a war of words.
We called for consultations today to discuss Iran's recent ballistic missile launches, which the United States condemns as dangerous destabilizing and provocative.
That was the U.S.'s permanent representative to the U.N., Samantha Power, at a press conference in New York Monday after a closed-door Security Council session that was convened at Washington's request.
Beyond just destabilizing the region, these launches were also in defiance of provisions of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231. The resolution that came into effect on January 16th on implementation day for the JCPOA. In that resolution, as you all know, Iran was, quote, called upon not to undertake any activity related to ballistic missiles designed to be capable of delivering nuclear weapons, including launches using such ballistic missile technology, end quote. Iran, however, continues to act as if this council has not spoken on the matter.
However, not everyone on the council agreed with Power's assertion that the missile tests were in violation of Resolution 2231. Among those taking a different view were Russia and China. Power was asked by a reporter about the position of Russia's Ambassador Vitaly Churkin during the session.
Russia seems to be lawyering its way to look for reasons not to act, rather than stepping up and being prepared to shoulder our collective responsibility.
According to a report in Reuters, Churkin said that the resolution's use of the word call was distinct from a ban, saying that legally, a call could not be violated, only complied with or ignored. Churkin said, according to the report, quote, the legal distinction is there, closed quote. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif immediately answered the charges brought by Ambassador Power, saying that the country's missile launches did not breach any UN Security Council resolutions.
Since we do not have nuclear warheads, and we have undertaken not to develop them, and the international community has put in place the best mechanisms that money can buy in order to make sure that we do not develop nuclear weapons, so we do not design any missiles to carry things that we do not have.
The foreign minister made the remarks at a press conference alongside Australian counterpart Julie Bishop in Canberra. Zarif's visit to Australia is the first by a senior Iranian official in more than a decade and is part of a tour by the foreign minister of Southeast Asia and the Pacific. U.S. and right-wing media in Brazil reporting on massive demonstrations across the country there. We spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, this past weekend about it.
What's happening in Brazil, as Emmett, I think there was a very short but incisive article by the Brazilian academic Emir Sader. I think it's in Telesur English, and it's well worth reading, because what Sader says is this is a decisive moment for Brazil's democracy, because the right wing, which has always been entrenched in the army and in the security forces, and have always been deeply corrupt. And this is the block of people, the Brazilian elite, most obviously represented by the O Globo media conglomerate. They are the people that have consistently resisted attempts by Lula da Silva, Dilma Rousseff, and all their colleagues in the Workers' Party to change Brazil, make Brazil more inclusive, make it more democratic, extend economic democracy to people. And they, as Emir Sader so rightly points out in his article, they were banking on Lula da Silva and Dilma Rousseff failing in their efforts to maintain a successful economy and carry out their policies of redistribution and so on. And they were wrong. In fact, Ignacio da Silva Lula and Dilma Rousseff, his successor as Brazilian president, have been extraordinarily successful until the global economic slowdown that has affected Brazil's economy. And there's so much to say about that. But the essential thing is that the right wing thought that they'd just naturally shift back into power via the electoral process. They were stunned when Dilma Rousseff defeated Aécio Neves, the right wing candidate, in the last presidential elections. And from that moment on, they've set out to destabilize Brazil in a very similar way to the way that the Venezuelan right wing actively trying to sabotage the Venezuelan economy. The Brazilian elites have tried to work with their Wall Street colleagues in particular to affect the Brazilian economy, especially via this kind of the pressure that's put on Brazil's financial or the financial obligations, its international financial obligations, its standing. You get the ratings agencies, as if they can be trusted for a second, lowering Brazil's financial rating in the international markets, and that makes it more expensive for Brazil to finance its many activities, the Brazilian government, in different ways. I'm not an economist, but and it's very clear that the Brazilian elites have been working with the international financial elites against the Brazilian government, in the same way that the Argentinian right-wing elites are working with the vulture funds, and did so against Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner when she was the Argentinian president.
Well, even Obama said that the rating agencies were, you know, political when they were battling, he and Congress were battling, and they were going towards a government shutdown a few years ago. And one of the rating agencies, I forget which one it was, but one of the major ones started to downgrade U.S. Paper.
Right.
He said, you know, that's political. He said it has nothing to do with economics, and shame on you people.
Right. Well, and something much, much more acute, a much more focused attack has been taking place over the last 18 months or so against the Brazilian economy, deliberately to destabilize the Brazilian government. And the Brazilian right wing are very much part of that. So they have very strong influence in the Brazilian security forces. And you can see that in the way that the police in Sao Paulo tried to repress a pro-Lula demonstration in Sao Paulo. And the right-wing elite in Brazil also have this entrenched influence in Brazil's largely corrupt judicial system. You know? Right. And so they're able, all they need to do is to buy a judge to get some unfriendly ruling against, in this case, Lula da Silva, or in another case, against Dilma.
Thus far, no luck with that, right? Because the judge declined to push forward any process against Lula for lack of evidence.
Right, exactly. So, but, you know, and that's and so you can say, oh, well, the Brazilian judicial system can't be that corrupt because, you know, what they tried to do didn't happen.
No, but just the cases that week, that's all.
They're not going to go away. They're just going to keep doing that they know, like the Venezuelan opposition, they know that all they have to do is keep chipping away. And sooner or later, they're going to get some political success, some political benefit as a result of their efforts. And that, you know, it's a bit like the United States, and shifting to a bigger regional level, the United States authorities and government know that all they have to do is to keep to maintain their position, and eventually something will go their way.
Right.
And that's why I think it's so false, going back to a strand of the conversation that we've had over the last couple of weeks, that's why I think it's so false to talk about a conservative restoration, because what you're talking about is a sustained, permanent assault on any progressive government or any progressive political movement. And that's, you know, we're going through a phase now where that permanent war, if you like, that permanent low-intensity war is getting some results in Venezuela, in Argentina, in Brazil at the moment. And that's what's happening. And so this judicial assault on Lula da Silva, and what they did last Friday, the day we had our last conversation, was they very publicly detained Lula in his house, and they searched his house with a search warrant from a judge. But they'd already tipped off the O Globo media conglomerate, and so all the right-wing Brazilian media were there to film it. and all those images have gone round the world, and so the and have penetrated deep into Brazilian society. So what they're trying to project, it's not just a judicial assault, it's also a media assault.
It's a perp walk. They basically staged a perp walk.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I'd forgotten that term that you have in the United States. Yeah,
that's what it is.
And so, and that is, as Emir Sada argues, I mean, I think Sada is absolutely right. What they're trying to do is prevent Ignacio Lula da Silva from being able to run as a candidate in the next presidential election.
Right.
Because they thought they'd win against Dilma, and they didn't. And they were furious about that. And now they see that if they don't neutralize in some way Lula as a potential presidential candidate, they may well lose the next presidential elections as well.
Yep. What happened, last year, was it that he ended up suing over allegations that were made in the media successfully, that
he won.
That he supposedly was involved in Petro, right?
Right. When he was detained by the police, he was subject to something like a 3-hour interrogation, right, asking the same questions that he'd already answered in a parliamentary inquiry,
right,
and that parliamentary inquiry exonerated him and Dilma Rousseff of any wrongdoing that were involved in these allegations that have resulted from the undoubted corruption that existed in Petrobras, the Brazilian state oil company. And although I suspect that the metaphor has to do with money laundering, that the media term that's been applied to that investigation is the car wash. The car wash scandal, and apparently it's to do with the way prominent Petrobras executives and prominent politicians, including right-wing politicians, but not just right-wing politicians, also some individuals from the Workers' Party, by all accounts, were getting payoffs and kickbacks and engaging in completely illegal behavior that was extremely detrimental to the public's interest in the Brazilian public's interest in the state oil company. So, but one of those people, as we've mentioned in the past, is Eduardo Cunha,
right,
the right-wing head of the lower house of Brazil's National Assembly, Congress. And he has been found to have, he and his family, a string of Swiss bank accounts.
Yeah, this is. Found after he called for Rousseff to be, for Dilma Rousseff to be impeached over corruption.
Yeah,
it turns out he's got Swiss bank accounts.
absolutely, but they, of course, they haven't turned up anything like that against Dilma Rousseff and Lula da Silva.
Right.
But they're downplaying the outrageous corruption involved Eduardo Cunha was involved in, and they're playing up these entirely false allegations that have already been discounted in a very demanding parliamentary inquiry. You know, so that because in the Brazilian Congress, the Workers' Party doesn't have a majority. I mean, they can't just, and if there is any kind of parliamentary scrutiny, it very much involves powerful right-wing political forces.
Yeah.
So if Lula came through that unscathed,
right,
it's completely superfluous and completely, it's a complete, and what the right wing, they couldn't do it by parliamentary means, so now they're trying to do it by illicit and dishonest use of the judicial and criminal system.
Yeah, well, what happened? You have the assault on Dilma Rousseff, 2014, 2015, and Lula was very helpful in terms of defending her. He's very popular, and he stood by Dilma Rousseff, and they were unable to take her down then, so they pushed back against him, and he ends up this front page article I forget the name of the magazine, that tries to link him to Petrobras, and he sues and wins against four or five of the people there, and then he announces, not announces, but he says in an interview, I think March 1st, yeah, I could well be running for president at, you know, in the next presidential election. And 3 days later, 4 days later, they're at his house with a, putting him on a perp walk.
Yeah, and it's so blatant, isn't it?
This way they can do it, though. See, they couldn't publish false accusations again, but the perp walk was a real event. Regardless of the merits of the case, they could report on it and show the image of him being led away by the police, and there's your money shot.
Yeah, but at the moment, it looks as though that's rebounded against them.
Yeah, so far, yep.
Because, and Lula da Silva, and he's a master politician, and he too knows how to use the media. And so he went on Brazilian TV shortly after his ordeal at the hands of the Brazilian police and made this really inspired declaration on Brazilian TV. And I think it's also on different websites. I think it's probably on YouTube too by now. And he made an extremely strong defense of himself, and also an extremely strong attack on the Brazilian right wing.
Right.
And I think that this may be the kind of thing that galvanizes the Brazilian progressive movement and the Brazilian popular movements, so that while they have legitimate and quite well-argued criticisms to make of Dilma Rousseff and the Workers' Party government's response to the current economic slowdown in Brazil in the context of a global slowdown, and they're likely to sink their differences with the Workers' Party and organize strongly to protect Ignacio Lula da Silva and make it possible for him to stand as a candidate in the next presidential election.
Right.
And that whole process is likely to mean is that as a result of that support that the Workers' Party and Dilma Rousseff's government and Lula da Silva get from the broader Brazilian popular movement, that will shift the political agenda of the Workers' Party, and Lula in particular, more towards the progressive end of the political spectrum and economic spectrum. So that, so the right wing are going to be even worse off in practical terms than they have been over the last 18 months. And that is why they're so desperate. They understand that.
Yeah.
So I think Emir Sada is right. This is a decisive moment for Brazil's political future. And will they be able to defeat this right-wing assault, which has nothing to do with the conservative restoration that's so touted by Western mainstream commentators, and everything to do with the desperation of the right wing in Latin America. If they can't win now, they never will.
Right. Yeah, the history is definitely moving against them. Well, it's cute the way he did that, though. You want to make me a front page story? Fine. Now I'm on the front page. Here's what I've got to say.
Right. Exactly.
All right, let's go to the slow-moving coup in Venezuela, because the same processes are at work there with different conditions, of course.
Yeah, and the situation in Venezuela is much more advanced than in terms of the right-wing's attack on the government of Nicolas Maduro. And Nicolas Maduro is the PSUV, the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, around Maduro, and they understand that it's a fight. It is a war, and it's a fight to the death, the political death, of one side or the other.
Yeah.
And so, over the last couple of weeks, Nicolas Maduro has introduced various economic reforms. He's made changes to the way foreign exchange is managed, for example, and he's made changes to the industrial policy of the Venezuelan government, trying to promote a much more accelerated industrial diversification. So, which is something many people think should have been, they should have prioritized that some time ago. But, and that's water under the bridge. So that he's doing that, and he's also trying to implement a much more secure distribution of basic foodstuffs and basic household items like toilet paper and soap and toothpaste and all that stuff.
Right, they handed over the distribution network to the social movements, right?
Right. So there's all that going on, and the right wing are trying to move forward, and I think they're going to go for what they call a referendo revocatorio, a national plebiscite over whether or not President Maduro should continue in power or not, which is part of the Venezuelan constitution. It's so ironic, isn't it, that the United States has again renewed its the presidential decree stating that Venezuela is a serious threat to the national security of the United States.
Yeah, right.
And they base that on their allegations that Venezuela isn't democratic and all the rest of their nonsense.
Right.
But at the same time, the right wing, not only have the right wing won control of the National Assembly, you know, how do you do that in a country that's not democratic?
Yeah, right.
They are now moving forward and taking advantage of a provision in the Venezuelan constitution that enables the people of Venezuela, if they want to remove the sitting president from office if they think he isn't doing a good job. Now, what other country in the world has that provision in their constitution?
Certainly
does the United
not.
States? Of
no,
course it does.
Hell no.
No.
We don't even have a direct. We don't even have a direct election of the president. We elect electors to the Electoral College.
Right. Yeah, and so which enabled George Bush to become president, even though he won fewer votes than Al Gore.
Yep,
so, right. You know, so all this deeply cynical, hypocritical, false commentary about the state of democracy in Venezuela, and what's reported in this is something that I do find extraordinary. What's reported even in the mainstream Western press directly contradicts their overall position that Venezuela is not a democracy. They report that the right wing have been elected to control the National Assembly. They report that the right wing are engaged in a revocatory referendum to unseat the president. But they still say, oh, well, Venezuela isn't a democracy.
Right. We're going to vote this dictator out of office.
Yeah, that's right. So, and I just find it astonishing that kind of people in North America and Western Europe don't kind of sit up and say, hang on a minute, this is entirely contradictory. We're not going to read this nonsense anymore. So the next couple of months will be crucial in Venezuela. So, and just as the situation, I was talking to my colleague Jorge Capellan the other day, and we agree that what seems to be happening is a kind of perfect storm of a combination, a coincidence of economic processes, political processes at a global level, and that's very much, you know, Latin America is very much the focus of that, because it is a very decisive period in which the neoliberal arguments and the arguments of the NATO countries led by the United States about how international relations should be managed, how the international economic structures should be managed. And that is very much coming to a head here in Latin America. And the essential argument is, well, are governments going to be run for the benefit of international corporations, or are they going to respond to the fundamental needs of their impoverished majorities here in Latin America?
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.